This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Tens of thousands of scientists warn we are in a climate emergency. Famous filmmaker David Attenborough says the climate crisis has come. But what can we do? How can we push our community into real action? Rebecca Harris, organizing director for the Climate Mobilization, is joined by activist Laura Berry to explain step by step how to get your town or rural area to declare a climate emergency and more. It is hosted by Dawn Hall from Transition US. The Transition Town movement in America has joined the Climate Mobilization for this insider presentation of how to move forward. Over 1,000 local governments, joined by 9 countries and the European Union, have already declared a climate emergency. This must go worldwide. Here we are going to learn how to do it. Our host is Dawn Hall from Transition US.
Transition US, for anybody who isn't familiar with us, is a national hub for the International Transition Towns Movement, supporting the growth and health of local communities, local initiatives to build community resilience all over the country in more than 100 locations. We got 2 other great events coming up that you might want to consider. Put on your calendar now. One is another free webinar with the founder of the Transition Towns Movement, Rob Hopkins, has recently published a new book called From What Is to What If, about the role of imagination in changing the world. He's going to be talking to us on February 18th. That's a Tuesday at the same time, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. And also want to make you aware of our second national gathering that is coming up this summer in Vermont at Castleton University, June 11th to 14th. And building on Rob's book and the power of imagination, which has been strong in the transition movement since the beginning, our theme is From What Is to What If, Reimagining and Rebuilding Our World. And we've already secured one of our keynote speakers, which is going to be Bill McKibben. We're also going to be having folks talking about Vermont's Farm to Plate program. Note these dates in your calendar and stay tuned to transitionus.org for registration information, as well as a call for workshop proposals. I want to introduce Laura and Rebecca. Laura Berry brings over a decade of experience in climate advocacy, organizing, and policy to her role as Research and Publications Director at Climate Mobilization. Her previous work with groups, including the Stockholm Environment Institute and 350.org, has spanned international and environmental politics, local climate change planning, and democratic public engagement. She has also published research on the intersections of activism and public engagement and facilitating environmental policy change. Laura now works to research and facilitate the development of emergency speed climate policy and governance frameworks in support of the climate mobilization's vision of a World War II scale climate mobilization. To introduce Rebecca Harris, who is the organizing director of the Climate Mobilization. She's a dynamic organizer who's been working for social justice since the age of 15, when she became involved in the peace movement in her hometown of Salem, Oregon. Rebecca joined the Climate Mobilization in February 2018, bringing a background in facilitation, fundraising, and strategic communications. Most recently, Rebecca worked as development and communications manager at Latino Union of Chicago and immigrants and workers' rights organizations. So very glad to have you with us as well, Rebecca.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dawn. It's really an honor to be here and with the folks on the call with the Transition Network. The Climate Mobilization has been a big fan of Transition US and Transition Network for a long time. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the emergency situation that we face with regards to climate change, as well as how local governments across the world are already leading in the response to this emergency. And then I'm going to pass it over to Rebecca, who is going to talk about how you can start a climate emergency campaign or a neighborhood group in your own community, as well as some details and resources about that, our programming. So I know it's pretty unlikely that I need to convince you of what we are facing right now, which is we are in a climate emergency. As it stands, we are currently at about 1.1 degrees Celsius of warming above and beyond pre-industrial conditions. And we are already seeing the impacts of climate change, of global warming across the world. We, if you've been paying attention to the news, you've seen the massive fires in the Australian bush. You've seen the fires from the Amazon last year. You've seen news of flooding, of people being displaced from their homes, of massive storms, of raging hurricanes. You know, millions of people every year are already being impacted by climate change, and civil unrest, famine, displacement, and even war are exacerbated by what we are experiencing right now. And this isn't just one degree of warming. We are on track, according to the World Meteorological Organization, to experience a temperature rise of 3 to 5 degrees Celsius, which is about 4.5 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit at our current, you know, levels of warming and at the rate that we are putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And last year, and I think quite a few of you probably have heard about this specific report, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said that we only have a decade to radically transform the economy in order to even have a 50% chance of avoiding the worst impacts of climate change. This is an emergency situation. We have essentially done what David Wallace Wells talked about in The Uninhabitable Earth. We've brought our planet to climate catastrophe in a single generation, although the roots of the emergency go back much longer, and we have the responsibility to address it as such. So this is our baseline. We know that the Earth is already too hot for safety and justice. We're experiencing the impacts of this climate emergency situation now, that we face an existential threat to society, to the lives of millions, if not billions of people, and we don't have any more time to sort of mess around about this. A gradual approach, the one that we've taken for the past 40 years, as some can argue, has not saved us, and it will not save us moving forward. We are in a moment right now where the climate emergency is putting billions of lives at risk, and we need our whole society to respond. But all of that said, I have some good news. We're finally understanding that this is an existential threat that we're facing, and we actually are building the power to rise up and to demand that our communities and our political leaders recognize that we are in a climate emergency and we need to have an emergency response. 2019 was pretty much a watershed sort of moment for the global climate emergency movement, which is this ever-growing group of activists, communities, and politicians who are rejecting this incrementalist change paradigm and are mobilizing across the world to save their homes, to save their communities, their families from these planetary impacts of climate change and ecological destruction that we're facing. According to Oxford Dictionaries, the use of the term climate emergency actually increased by over 10,000% in 2019. And they named it its world, you know, sort of the word of the year was climate emergency. 11,000 scientists worldwide have united and said, you know, this is a climate emergency and we need massive transformative change in order to address it. You know, this is not a question of scientific consensus anymore. We recognize what the problem is and what we need to do. And what we're going to talk about a little bit more is how new and existing environmental groups across the United States and across the world have taken on the call to declare a climate emergency in their own communities and to push their governments from the local to the national to the international to recognize this existential threat through declaring a climate emergency and starting to take emergency action. So as of this morning, we have over 1,311 climate emergencies declarations have been passed globally in 25 countries, and 73 of those climate emergency declarations have been passed in the United States, including cities, major cities like New York and Los Angeles, all the way down to my own hometown of Bar Harbor, Maine, a tiny little town of only a couple thousand people. You know, and the increase in climate emergency declarations, again, in 2019 was explosive. You know, we started the year off with only 233 declarations worldwide and ended with over 1,300. So the growth of this movement has significantly increased in the past year, which is really inspiring in a lot of ways. And it's not slowing down, at least not that we can tell. So I'm going to talk a little bit about actually what a climate emergency declaration is, because I think there's some confusion sometimes about what this means. And for us at TCM, a climate emergency declaration is a tool. It's a piece of legislation or it's a directive that has essentially says that a government or an organization is on record in support of taking emergency action to restore a safe climate. Now, what this means is that a local government has recognized the existential nature of climate change, you know, what we talked about at the beginning, and has also committed to doing what it can in order to address that existential threat. And that in an ideal world means for us reaching zero greenhouse gas emissions as quickly as possible to avoid the at the most harm possible to communities. So climate emergency declarations ideally are meant to set this goal of as quickly as possible reducing and eliminating greenhouse gas emissions, and also to begin safely drawing down carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, because we already know the planet is already too hot. We're not at a safe level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so our goal is not simply to limit the harm, but we want to reverse the harm. We want to restore a safe climate. We don't want to just, put a Band-Aid on the problem, essentially. So the declaration is a statement. It's a tool for local organizers and local communities to say our governments have committed to this and we're going to figure out a way to get there together as a community. One of the biggest questions is, what does passing this declaration actually do? But all governments, all of us, all individuals, our community groups, churches, schools, we have the power to begin mobilizing in the face of the climate emergency. Because a climate emergency requires an emergency response, something different than what we've been doing so far. And so in how we are addressing climate change, how we're taking action from the individual level up to the government level. So acknowledging the truth of the existential threat is really critical, actually, from a psychological perspective. And passing a local climate emergency declaration is the first step towards that. So once we have that, and especially given that at the moment we have very limited federal leadership on climate change, local governments are a place where we can actually engage and push towards significant action in a way that we haven't before. The way that we talk about this, at least, is about shifting into emergency mode. Right now, we are working in normal mode, which is what our founder, Dr. Margaret Klein Salomon, talks about insofar as the differences between how groups function when they don't have something, an existential threat or an immediate impact looming over them versus emergency mode when all of the resources that they have are dedicated towards solving this crisis. So this chart here is in Margaret Klein Salomon's paper, Leading the Public into Emergency Mode, in which she describes the differences between how normally, just me sitting here in normal mode, I am sort of balancing my priorities. I might be a little bit thirsty, so I'll get some water after this. I'm focused on a number of things. Whereas in an emergency, if this building that I'm sitting in was on fire, my top priority would be getting people out of the building, getting myself out of the building, and dealing with the problem at hand. And so emergency mode happens when an individual faces an existential threat. And right now, climate change, the climate emergency, is that existential threat. We have to refocus all of our attention from the individual level all the way up to governments at the national level to address this problem, because it's what we have to do in the face of the impacts that we're facing. When it comes to what we discuss, when we think about the big picture and we think about everyone shifting into emergency mode, this is what climate mobilization means. We have to, as a nation, as a world, shift into emergency mode and to basically change the way that our economy and society is working towards an equitable, zero emissions, regenerative economy that we need to protect people and species, the species that we share this planet with. I can talk a little bit about, maybe in the Q&A, the sort of historic context of this and how the United States entered emergency mode and mobilized during World War II, and how social movements have plenty of examples of people in emergency mode. But this webinar is focused specifically on local governments. So I want to talk a little bit about how we see local action as we're building up to this ultimate goal of climate mobilization, of this major society and economy-wide shift that we need, that really is the only rational response left to the existential risk of climate change. Why focus on local communities when we are talking about this big, national, international need to mobilize? So since 2016, the vast majority of the climate emergency declarations that have passed at local levels of government. Only nine countries and the European Union have passed sort of national or supranational climate emergency declarations. And that's because people, generally speaking, have more access and trust more their local officials and local community leaders when it comes to actually making change and seeing an impact with regards to activism and pushing for that. So local governments, town councils, county boards of commissioners generally don't have the same budgetary or legal regulatory powers as obviously higher levels of government do. However, you know, our approach to this depends on the fact that there are government champions and activists who recognize that this is an existential threat and that they are going to do everything that they can, even if they alone can't reduce their greenhouse gas emissions to zero at emergency speed. They know that they can set stronger targets. They can set the framework. They can say, we're going to try to do this and we're going to do it as quickly as possible, as, you know, as much as we can. So working downwards, essentially. They can work upwards. They can actually act as advocates, publicly advocating for an emergency response from multiple levels of government. So a small town like the one that I live in can advocate publicly for the state of Maine and the national government to have an emergency response on climate change, to actually provide funding and resources for us at the local level to adapt. And then outwards, the climate emergency is going to take everyone, and engaging everyone will require businesses, individuals, communities, everyone to actually understand the threat that we face, to be in emergency mode. And so local governments can take a role in actually building that understanding culturally, and also to building power to actually fight for the end goal of mobilization that we need.
This is the Transition U.S. Climate Mobilization Workshop, broadcast by Radio EcoShock. Here is Laura Berry from the Climate Mobilization.
I want to take just a second to talk a little bit about what a climate emergency response isn't, since I think a lot of people, after climate emergency declarations are passed, are curious as to what happens next. And, you know, at a local level, an emergency response program, some of which I'll talk about afterwards, will of course likely include policies on things like renewable energy, on energy efficiency, land use, transportation, you know, the sort of the typical things that we talk about with regards to climate change and sustainability. Those will inevitably look different from community to community. So in my town, heating during the winter is a huge source of greenhouse gas emissions, but that might not be the same for a town in California or a town in Iowa. And so essentially, when we talk about forming a climate emergency program at the local level, we have to set some boundaries, one of which is we have to recognize that as quickly as possible, reducing and eliminating greenhouse gas emissions has to be the goal and the baseline by which we take our actions and by which governments take action. Similarly, we have to recognize that incrementalist policies that may have worked possibly, you know, a couple decades ago are not going to be the solution at this moment, at least not alone. And similarly, individual behavior such as, recycling or going vegan, these are incredibly important things, but they aren't an emergency response. This isn't the whole sort of package of what we need to be doing. And similarly, community climate action programs, which are amazing and wonderful, but might not have the impact that we actually need in terms of emergency rapid speed action. Again, these are important things, but they're not what we're talking about with regards to the scale and the speed and the scope of action that we need to take. Because when the goal is to provide maximum protection for people, we have to actually act like it's an emergency. So this is a comic from the Australian bushfires where, you know, we have needs right now. Our communities are suffering from the impacts of climate change, and we can't push off these very real realities until 20 whenever. We have to act now. And so it's incredibly important to act within the context of the national global mobilization effort when we're talking about local policy. So in the United States, we haven't had a lot of time between most of the climate emergency declarations that were passed and now. It's really the vast majority of them were passed only in the last year. So many local governments and many local climate emergency groups are actually working in the process of developing these emergency programs as we speak. But I can speak to a couple of ones that are already existing. So in July of 2019, Los Angeles, which was one of the first sort of big climate emergency groups and campaigns that TCM has worked with, made history through establishing the world's first ever Office of the Climate Mobilization, a Climate Emergency Mobilization Director. So this was pretty much a new government office in the city, funded with $1 million of seed funding and with the explicit goal of a rapid mobilization to achieve zero emissions, carbon neutral, regenerative, egalitarian economy with the principles of a just transition as an actual government policy, which is fantastic and was the result of months of local organizing from a local environmental justice coalition called Leap LA, and also includes goals for getting obviously to zero emissions, but also working with community assemblies and marginalized communities across the city to ensure that community engagement was a core part of this mobilization process. So this is an example of what I'm talking about when we talk about climate emergency mode. It is about shifting resources. It's about shifting government operations, the ways in which we think about democracy towards addressing this problem. Because, you know, the LA City Council didn't know how to mobilize, but they needed to put resources. They needed to talk to people who were going to be impacted by climate change to understand what this emergency mobilization was going to look like. Just going to mention this. Berkeley, California is another example. This is one specific policy, and I know that I spoke about the need to not focus on specific policies, but it's pretty significant. After they declared a climate emergency, Berkeley, California has been, and other cities across California have been investigating how to actually respond to the climate emergency with policy. And one thing that happened was a natural gas ban, essentially a de facto ban in new residential buildings, which is really significant because 25% of greenhouse gas emissions in California comes from buildings. So this is one step towards the kind of emergency action. You know, outright banning fossil fuels is something that more and more cities are exploring in response to the climate emergency. And 13 other cities now in California have actually followed suit and done the same. So again, it's about expanding the impact of these actions and publicly advocating for other cities to follow. I'm going to skip Durban. Durban was the very first place in the world to declare a climate emergency, and they have a fundamental, a fantastic climate emergency plan. But essentially, it covers emergency speed, decarbonization, drawing down carbon emissions, and an immense outreach and advocacy program that this city, the small city of Durban in Australia, which is currently on fire, is working on to declare a climate emergency, which they've already done, and then act like it. And then the last thing, in Oxford, in the United Kingdom, we had a really incredible response after the city declared a climate emergency and actually created a citizens' assembly, a representative body of local citizens to deliberate on the climate emergency and come up with recommendations. And they not only recommended that the city go faster than what the UK government was doing, insofar as saying we needed to be, they want to be carbon neutral by this year, and then also led to a £19 million investment towards energy efficiency, cutting transport emissions, increasing renewable energy, you know, an entire package, not just one specific policy. So this is a really another great example of looking at, here's how cities are shifting into emergency mode. We're not quite there yet, obviously, in the United States, but this is what we've been working on. So thank you very much. I'm going to pass it off to Rebecca now.
Thanks so much, Laura. So I'm going to be talking a bit about concretely what it is we can do to build the climate emergency movement in our neighborhoods, in our towns, in our counties, and in the organizations that we're part of and are working with. So first, I just want to take a bit of a step back. We have a lot of great victories, a lot of great success stories that Laura has just shared. And we also want to be clear, though, that there's immense vested interest backing the current system, and that the changes we need to create are going to impact everyone and every facet of our lives, every business, every kitchen, every home, every school, everyone. And these changes are going to cost a lot of money. They're going to take a lot of resources, a lot of effort to create, and they could greatly shift who profits. And because of that, there are already people who are trying to sacrifice our survival for their short-term gain. But we also know that there's millions of people who's looking for the change that we can create. There's actually a recent poll that came out that showed that 56% of all registered voters, or at least 82 million Americans, actually believe that climate change is an emergency. They agree with us. And they want to protect their families, their neighborhoods, and their communities from the climate emergency. And so we are working to grow the movement in our neighborhoods, in our cities, in our counties, through local climate emergency campaigns and through neighborhood climate emergency groups. So I'm going to be sharing a bit more about some of the ways that you can get involved in just a couple minutes. We are currently working with local climate emergency campaigns in about 90 cities across the US and Canada. Of those, most of them, about 85, are in the United States. And we work with climate groups. We work with individuals who started these campaigns, with faith groups that have started these campaigns. And we've seen that number double just in the last several months. So this is something that's growing, that's on the upswell, and that we're really excited about sharing with all of you so that you have the opportunity to consider potentially joining this movement as well. Our strategy for making an impact and building towards the emergency climate mobilization that we want to create is to make the climate emergency the central issue of the 2020 election by continuing to grow climate emergency campaigns this year and also working to confront candidates for elected office and push them to respond to the emergency. We're also demanding action from local governments, just like Laura just talked about. We're working as a movement to strengthen the mass climate strikes planned for this year and next, and working to reach and unite with the 82 million Americans who agree with us so that we can build a large, powerful movement. So I'm going to talk a little bit now about how you can take action in your community through a climate emergency campaign. We believe that in this moment, we need everyone to build a large and powerful movement. So we're making it easy for you with a number of resources that we're going to share. And for those of you listening in on the radio, we are going to share a little bit later on a sign-up link that you can use to sign up and get information and resources on starting a local climate emergency campaign. So we have created a timeline that spells out step-by-step as an easy recipe you can follow to get a climate emergency push started in your community, leading to passing a climate emergency declaration, and then to getting your community to launch a climate emergency program. And we'll be talking through some of the first couple steps that you can do to get a climate emergency push started in your community, starting with getting ready, then reaching out to partner organizations, talking to other groups in your community about a climate emergency effort, and then a tool we're going to share with you called the Climate Emergency Response Training, which is an educational workshop that we're releasing to all of you that you can put on for others in your community in order to orient them and bring them on board with this work. So first step of starting a climate emergency campaign is to find people to work with. We suggest finding an organization you're already involved in to start a climate emergency push. This could be a local transition group you're already part of. It could be a climate group you're part of, or it could be another group in your community you know that wants to take it on. If none of those groups come to mind, you could even work with a group of friends or a faith community to start a climate emergency campaign. Then we really suggest, as part of starting your climate emergency push, getting in touch with other organizations in your community. These could be other climate groups, environmental justice organizations in your area, Indigenous tribal governments. These organizations could be neighborhood groups, parent groups, student groups, really any type of organization where people come together and where you can make contact and begin a conversation around the climate emergency and whether joining a climate emergency campaign might mesh with some of these other organizations' goals. We have found that across the board, the strongest climate emergency campaigns that are able to make the biggest impact with their local governments are those that bring together several different organizations. And they're even more powerful when they bring together many different types of organizations in the community. And we recommend opening a conversation about the climate emergency through something that's called a one-on-one that might be familiar to those of you who've done other community organizing work. So this is basically a coffee meeting, short 30, 45 minutes, talking with someone that you know or an acquaintance or a friend of a friend, really working to build a relationship and get a sense of how they see themselves, what their story is, and assuming it's someone from an organization you're trying to engage, also getting a sense of what that organization's work is, what their goals are, what their priorities are, and what they are trying to accomplish. In the context of a climate emergency campaign, you can frame it as asking for advice or getting their thoughts on your work, getting their opinion on something, right? But really, you're listening to them first and then only talking second, right? In one of these meetings, to build a strong relationship, we want to listen about 80% of the time and talk just about 20% of the time. And then really think about what could their role be in a climate emergency push? How might it line up with what they're trying to accomplish? How might it help them meet their goals as an individual or their goals with the organization that they work with? And then, although this is not a time to talk at length about a campaign, we want to move them towards some type of a next step, whether asking for a second meeting to talk about more nuts and bolts, or straight up asking them if they would join the campaign, or just asking them who else you should talk to and who else you should be in conversation with.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to a recording by Transition US. We learn how to push for climate action with activists Rebecca Harris and Laura Berry from the Climate Mobilization. This is Rebecca Harris from the Climate Mobilization.
The first step after you have thought through who is running the climate emergency campaign is really to start conversations with other organizations in your area and begin opening a dialogue about what a climate emergency response might look like in your community. And after that, we really encourage people to start reaching out to other individuals in their community through what we call climate emergency response trainings. So this is a short workshop that immediately puts people to work on a climate emergency campaign. And we're going to be releasing this curriculum to all of you after today's webinar. It's completely scripted out for you as part of our organizing guide. It can ideally be held every 2 to 4 weeks to bring in a new group of people to learn about the climate emergency and take action. And it's set up so that it fills its own seats. There's time in the workshop for the people who are there to actually list out who they want to invite to the next workshop. So we think this is a great community building and education tool around the climate emergency. I'm going to talk a little bit now about another option for starting a climate emergency push in your community, and this is around starting block-based or neighborhood-based groups. So we know that many different movements and organizations organize themselves using small groups. So schools use small groups. We also have seen the global justice movement organize itself very powerfully using affinity groups. Extinction Rebellion and many other groups organize using small groups to build a large, powerful movement, neighborhood watches. And we also have seen many other movements, from evangelical Christian churches to household workers movements, workers' rights movements, organize large, powerful presences using small groups. We have a couple other folks chiming in. 350 Mass uses nodes to organize. Mothers Out Front does, faith-based groups, block parties, groups fighting eminent domain threats. All of these are movements that have grown strong and powerful using the power of small groups. So we are now calling on folks who, you know, would like to get something started in their community and maybe don't have the time or energy to start a full climate emergency campaign, to begin organizing in their neighborhoods. Right, as a way to build stronger relationships, as a way to create involvement for people who have less time to participate, and as a way to help us weave together a stronger movement. And so we have a curriculum we're going to be sharing for neighborhood groups to use as well with folks who want to sign up to take action. And this curriculum has three key pieces to it: growth, community, and action. We have a host of ideas for neighborhood groups to take on centered around these three pieces. Right? So neighborhood groups can work to grow the movement by engaging and recruiting more people. They can work to do outreach to organizations, like we just talked about, or they can hold climate emergency response trainings in order to grow the climate emergency movement. Neighborhood groups can also hold social events, hold educational events with call to action. I'm really excited to share as well that we are going to be releasing new tools around climate grief support groups. And we see that as a great avenue for neighborhood climate emergency groups to explore as well. And some of those tools are going to be coming out in conjunction with our executive director, Margaret Klein-Salomon's new book, Facing the Climate Emergency, Transform Yourself with the Power of Climate Truth. And that book is going to be coming out, I believe, in early April, and we'll be releasing the tools then or shortly after. So all of these resources that I mentioned, our climate emergency campaign guide, our climate emergency response training curriculum, and our guide to starting a neighborhood group, you can access all of these by signing up at tinyurl.com/transitionclimateemergency. Again, that's tinyurl.com/transitionclimateemergency. And so we'll send you then a guide to starting a climate emergency campaign. We'll send you a guide to starting a neighborhood climate emergency group, as well as a recording of this call. So now we have some time set aside for Q&A. So John, would you like to get us started with some of the questions?
The first question is about why so many people resist change. Would the lifestyle changes be so hard, required to address the climate emergency, or is it too late?
Our executive director, Margaret Klein-Salomon, has done a lot of work on this topic of why people resist change or why people don't understand that we're in an emergency. She's talked about something called pluralistic ignorance, which is psychological research that actually shows that if you're around people who are not acting like it's an emergency, you are not going to act like it's an emergency. You're going to not understand the seriousness of the problem, and you're not going to act accordingly. And so this is why we think this piece of naming this as an emergency is so key, and getting our governments, getting our society into emergency mode. So that's a lot of what our work centers around, is creating an environment that's conducive for people to understand and act accordingly.
Do you want to add anything to that, Laura?
Getting into emergency mode is something that is a very personal process on climate change. I think many people on this call have been concerned about environmental issues for a long time. I mean, both Rebecca and I have worked on climate change since we were teenagers, and have found that this sort of emergency framing is something that is incredibly compelling and drives us to do the work that we do. And so I think when it comes to local action, it does go beyond just sort of recycling or encouraging people to eat less meat, but really is about saying, okay, my life's work is about doing what I can as an individual to address this problem. I mean, that does mean working in collaboration with everyone else. So, you know, when it comes to what's going to be difficult about the climate emergency, is dealing with the massive societal changes that are going to be required. But that also comes with massive potential for us to build a better society together, which is also incredibly exciting. So I've found that when I talk to people about climate change, it's much better to talk about potential for how the world could be better than actually the sort of the sacrifices that we have to make, because we will have to make sacrifices, but there's a point, and the point is to have a world where everyone can be happy and healthy and have a safe climate. So I think it's important how we talk about it, and learning from the sort of social psychology of behavioral change and societal change and social movements is really helpful in that.
So that was a very big picture question. This is more a technical question. Would a climate emergency declaration protect a town from legal action by developers or others who might feel like their interests are harmed by this?
That is a really interesting question. And it does have to do with sort of the legal jurisdiction of a specific municipality. You know, one of the issues that we face in the United States is actually kind of a kneecapping of local democracy when it comes to what towns can actually do with regards to limiting greenhouse gas emissions and making choices, making local democratic choices about the kind of town that they want to build and to have. So with regards to local developers, we haven't experienced that yet with the climate emergency resolution. We actually have, for example, in the Berkeley example that I talked about, and in California, we've experienced, you know, using the resolution not as the legal sort of mandate or the legal ability to take further action, but as sort of a baseline upon which new regulatory structures and new legislation is being passed. And so it's not necessarily that the emergency declaration grants new or specific legal powers or ability to towns to do something, but it does give local organizers and activists something to say, you know, this is an emergency. You've recognized this formally as the body, you know, as a governmental body. And so we need to do as much as possible. So in Berkeley, like the example with the natural gas ban, that was something that was questionable as to whether or not the cities had the legal jurisdiction to go ahead and make that call. And so far, they basically were changing not zoning regulations, but public safety building codes to prevent the installation of natural gas. And it was a question, actually, as to whether the state regulatory agency was going to allow that to happen. But because local authorities have basically regulatory ability over public health and public safety, it was something that they were able to do. So it's going to depend, honestly, on local regulation and local statute and state, you know, statute about what's going to be possible in a climate emergency response. But again, this was something that they hadn't done before, that they hadn't investigated whether they could do before. And as a result of the climate emergency declaration and that sort of need to find new and creative ways to address greenhouse gas emissions, that the city and now multiple cities across California are doing something really significant on limiting fossil fuel infrastructure and use.
Radio EcoShock.
This is the Transition U.S. Climate Mobilization Workshop, broadcast by Radio EcoShock.
This one, I think, is about how do we ensure that the steps that are taken as a result of climate emergency plans are holistic solutions that don't have serious negative unintended consequences. One person wrote, "I have studies showing the extraordinary energy and conflict minerals embodied in manufacturing solar panels and wind turbines. Do you know anyone doing due diligence evaluations on renewables?"
That is a difficult one, because when we talk about transition and when we talk about a renewable energy future, many, many studies have shown sort of the inevitable consequence of if we were to replace every single kilowatt hour or joule's worth of energy with regards to the energy that we use right now in the society that we use right now in the economy that we have, it would take an immense amount of material resources to make that happen. And so the question and the way that TCM approaches our vision of mobilization has actually to do with massively decreasing our energy use as a society and our material use as a society. So because we recognize that risk and we recognize that we need a system that is not built upon extractive industry that harms both communities and the planet. So off the top of my head, I actually don't have specific resources about conflict minerals and the use of, you know, rare earth minerals in renewable energy systems. But I do know, at the very least, since the inevitability is that we do use energy as a society, and even if we massively decrease that energy use, that there's still going to be need to be solar panels and wind turbines and all of these zero emissions sources of energy and electricity in order to provide a good life for people. But again, I mean, the bigger question is about, you know, how do we ensure a just transition for people? And that includes the people who are working to provide us with the resources that we need to transition off of fossil fuels, but also for the people who right now are working in the fossil fuel industry and are already suffering as a result of dirty energy and dirty energy extraction, which we know we need to get off of. So in some ways, we know we need to keep extracting resources, but there are ways to do it in a way that is more sustainable and better, and hopefully with the end goal of not continuing to do it, building a more sustainable energy system.
There was a question about Do you have a list of current groups that have already created? And
there is actually a list of declarations that have been passed worldwide. In terms of the campaigns we work with in the U.S., we don't have a list publicly, but if you sign up through the forum, if you're interested in potentially starting something, we will connect you if there is a group in your area.
There were also a few questions around other organizations potentially to collaborate with. Are there any that you're working with on the national level? Maybe Drawdown, Sierra Club, Food and Water Watch? Are there other large environmental organizations that have been joining in the climate emergency effort?
Yeah, on the National Climate Emergency Declaration Campaign, which you can find online at climateemergency.us, that's climateemergency.us, there's a number of groups that have partnered with us on that campaign, including Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, Progressive Democrats of America, Food and Water Action, which is the 501c4 affiliate of Food and Water Watch. Mothers Out Front is a partner organization as well, in addition to many other groups that are working to pass a climate emergency declaration through Congress. And we're thrilled to announce that currently there is 91 co-sponsors in the House and about 9 in the Senate, including most of the presidential candidates in the Senate. We are making an impact through that work. And then in terms of other organizations, we also work with chapters of many other groups that are running climate emergency campaigns using our tools. So it's not just climate mobilization chapters running these campaigns. In some cases, there are local 350 groups, Sunrise chapters, there are Extinction Rebellion chapters running climate emergency campaigns. And we're hoping that after today, there may be transition chapters, transition groups running these campaigns as well. I forgot to mention Elders Climate Action. We're partnering with them as well for their members and their chapters to start climate emergency campaigns.
Another couple of real practical questions here. Andrew asks, is there a way to connect with others in starting a climate emergency campaign in my local area? How to find other people who are interested in this, perhaps through your platform?
So if you sign up on the link that was mentioned, tinyurl.com/transitionclimateemergency, we will follow up with you around next steps. And if there's not already a group in your area, if you're looking to start something, we can actually reach out to folks on the climate mobilizations list to see if any of those folks would be interested in joining with you. Of course, it is easier if you can work with an existing group as well, but we are also happy to push out new climate emergency campaigns to our email and text list and see who in your area might be interested in joining.
All right. And we had one here from Ken.
That was about a question about including an example of a climate emergency declaration that had passed in the United States with the materials, which, yes, we will find a couple of examples, as well as TCM provides a template resolution for climate emergency organizers to get started and to tailor to their own individual town or municipality that is within the organizing materials that we're going to send out.
Caroline asks, could you talk more about the citizens groups or councils that form with their local governments after a climate emergency has been declared? These, I understand, move the declarations into action. Some examples of these actions would also be appreciated. How are these groups or councils organized with working groups focused on various topics?
Right. So, you know, I think there's a couple of different sort of options after a climate emergency declaration is passed to actually then bring the town sort of closer to emergency mode action itself. The example that I gave in Oxford in the United Kingdom is an example of a citizens assembly, which is a representative group of local citizens that are tasked with learning about the climate emergency and potential solutions that the city could take. And they deliberate on these potential solutions and vote, come up with essentially a plan or a series of recommendations for the town. So that's one example of community, you know, sort of community engagement through forming a new group to essentially dedicated towards solving at least, or, you know, coming up with this emergency plan at the local level. For other cities, a good example in the United States at a smaller level than Los Angeles was New Haven, Connecticut. They, as part of their climate emergency declaration, set up a climate emergency task force, which again is sort of a mix of government officials and local citizens that are working to come up with and identify the most effective emergency speed sort of actions towards decreasing greenhouse gas emissions, rolling out renewable energy, working with citizens, you know, increasing biodiversity and green space, you know, all of these intersecting issues for their town specifically. So there are a number of different sort of formats in which, you know, towns can essentially create what I like to think of as the institutional structure for a climate emergency response. And in Los Angeles, that looks like a massive department, a major department within the town or the city council itself, and then also programs underneath that. But at the very small level, that might just look like a task force and maybe hiring, et cetera, in order to get them to that goal. So what we really want to focus on, though, is encouraging citizen engagement in this process, which we see is incredibly important. There was a question about how do you make this fundamentally, you know, both an emergency speed program and a democratic one. And I think that, at least for us, is really about using this emergency response and using the climate emergency declaration as the reason for actually talking to constituents and talking to citizens about what they need in the face of climate change and what they think is going to be the most effective way to protect their communities and to work together to get to where we need to be, which is zero greenhouse gas emissions. So citizens' assemblies are huge in the United Kingdom and in Europe. It's something that is increasing in support and sort of popularity in the United States as a way to do this both at once, you know, engage with people and understand what they're facing and what their fears are and what they think the solutions are. And then also to create a really series of concrete recommendations on how we get to zero emissions very quickly, but then local governments, you know, move forward from there. So I agree, it definitely is important after a climate emergency declaration to have some sort of structure institutionally at the local government level to carry out that work afterwards. That you can't just pass a declaration and, you know, sort of say, okay, we've passed a declaration, that's it.
All right, and maybe one more here. There was a question about what is the definition of getting to 100? But is it just shifting the town's electricity usage? Or are we thinking about all aspects of energy consumption, including transportation?
When we talk about 100% or zero, rather, we talk about zero, you know, rather than 100%. We talk about zero greenhouse gas emissions. And we mean that. We don't mean net zero. We don't mean clean energy economy or anything else. What we recognize is that every single molecule of carbon dioxide that we put into the atmosphere is adding to the massive risk of this problem. And so we recognize the scale and the scope and the challenges and the difficulties of massively overhauling our energy system, which is only about 71% of our greenhouse gas emissions nationwide. We recognize that this is a really difficult problem to be facing. It is the problem to be facing. But we also recognize the need to not beat around the bush when it comes to what we are actually aiming for here as a society. And so zero greenhouse gas emissions as a target and by 2030, but really as quickly as possible. We needed zero greenhouse gas emissions to begin with, you know. So by using that language and by using that framing, and not just talking about the component parts, which of course we need 100% renewable energy system. We need, you know, zero carbon manufacturing. We need zero carbon transportation. All of these things are incredibly important. But by talking about the actual goal, which is to not have mostly carbon free economy, and then we offset the rest of it because we planted some trees. But really saying, what would it look like to envision a zero carbon world? That gives us the opportunity to, number one, hold ourselves accountable to really, really strong, very fast climate action and not just sort of allow ourselves to say, oh, well, we can do this and it's mostly fine. And secondly, it allows us to actually envision that world. It gives us the framework where we can say, what does the world post-transition look like if we're actually aiming for zero greenhouse gas emissions? What does that mean? What does that actually, you know, mean that we have to do as a society and as a world? So I'm all for talking about 100% renewable energy. And when these terms mean something, I think it's important. But yes, I think that saying, as a town, we are committing to doing everything we can to get to zero greenhouse gas emissions is an incredibly important step, even if you know that you probably aren't going to get there, because you're taking that stance publicly and taking that stance as a campaign and saying to others, to other groups, to other governments, to the world, this is where we need to be. And we're taking, you know, we're taking the chance at saying this publicly and actually trying, and you need to join us too so that we can get there. And even if we only get 70% of the way, that's still better than where we are right now. So that's my feelings on the language of 100% versus zero. Rebecca, if you have any other thoughts, I'm...
I'd like to actually just quickly, before we wrap up, take a couple of the other questions folks had. There was a question around inserting a climate emergency message into political campaigns, both nationally and locally. We've been really excited to actually see the Bernie Sanders campaign, as well as a couple other presidential campaigns, pick up the messaging of climate change being an emergency. And we think that we can do that with local campaigns as well, with campaigns for Congress as well. Somebody was mentioning in particular the Democratic primary for city council in Washington, D.C. So, you know, you can reach out to and build relationships with candidates in that primary, one or more candidates, and ask them to really bring this issue front and center. You can ask them to join in climate emergency actions to start showing up and themselves advertising that to the media. That's one way that you could get them to potentially take this message on. You can also, you know, work with folks that are planning candidate forums, debates, other events, try to get them to insert the messaging into those events. And then, of course, the other way we can put this message into action during campaign season is by bird dogging candidates, confronting them, demanding that they answer the tough questions about how we can really respond to the emergency. Andrew, thanks for the question about individual behaviors as well. If a whole community adopts those behaviors, that would be great. Those are the types of change we need. We believe that we are not likely to get a whole community adopting the behaviors we need unless we have that message coming through the government, through the media, right? Not just from our climate organizations. And so that's why we're really working to shift all of society into emergency mode, is because that's where we think we can get the impact from behavior change, is when we have public service announcements around it, when we have those changes actually being supported by policy changes that make it easier for people to live without flying, right? Not just from our individual behaviors. One more quick question. I see a question on rural and conservative areas passing climate emergency declarations. We've seen an explosion in the last few months of lots of climate emergency campaigns in more rural areas and more conservative areas and in more red states and swing states. There are versions of the declaration that have been created for those areas. So with that, I'd like to move us along to just talking through your next steps and your takeaways. What is your next step in putting what we have talked about today into action?
Yeah, big thank you to Laura and Rebecca and the Climate Mobilization. Also wanted to give a big thank you to Post Carbon Institute, who partnered with us on this event and helped get the word out, probably brought many of you here. If you're not familiar with Post Carbon, please visit their website at postcarbon.org. Go to transitionus.org. So thank you. This is just the beginning here. Please be in touch with us at Transition US if we can support in any way.
That concludes the online seminar held Tuesday, January 13th, 2020. Find more at www.theclimatemobilization.org. and www.transitionus.org. I will post more links in my weekly show blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening. We cannot give up. Let you and I be the spark plugs that help fire humanity into action to save our climate and our future. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. The world's oceans have absorbed most of our heat energy as we burn through fossil power. A new study confirms this. The seas are hotter, and we are just beginning to guess what that means. Is the future already written, with heat coming from the ocean relentlessly over decades and centuries? In coming weeks, I will speak with the top world scientist and co-author of that study. Meanwhile, the American fracking party continues. There is such a glut of natural gas that Texan companies are just dumping this raw methane into the atmosphere or flaring it. I will speak with the journalist who covers the most alarming developments there. Yes, I know Tesla can hardly keep up with orders for electric cars. Germany has just closed a deal with their coal owners and miners to end the worst warming product, brown coal. That shutdown will happen sometime in the 2030s, when it is far too late. And none of this is in the news, so carefully stuffed with stories about a prince, a president, and the weather. The climate emergency is now. The time has come. Please do what you can to get this known and to start our desperate defense. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.